Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Obviously, that $700 million makes a difference.
New projections show Wisconsin is poised to receive around $700 million less than originally expected in federal COVID relief aid. Lawmakers advanced bills that would make changes to policing practices in the state, the first measures passed by the legislature to do so since George Floyd's murder last year. And Wisconsin's five House Republicans were among those who pushed to remove a top congresswoman from her leadership role in the chamber. Rewind, your week in review. For May 14th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we are coming to you live in person together from the Wisconsin Eye Studio. A bit of a return to normalcy, huh, JR?
Yes, feels good to be back.
Very, very exciting. Well, let's get into it. We've got a lot to cover. First topic this week is Wisconsin is expected to get $700 million less in federal COVID funds. The U.S. Treasury Department guidance shows that Wisconsin will receive $2.5 billion rather than the originally projected $3.2 billion under the American Rescue Plan Act. The reduction is due to an improvement in the state's unemployment rate, and the money will be split into two payments 1 year apart. Governor Evers and U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin have asked the feds to reconsider the payment approach. They said in their letter, quote, "The split in timing does not necessarily reflect the urgency or the level of need that many businesses, families, workers, and community organizations have right now." Three members of the Democratic congressional delegation also sent a letter requesting that the payments be delivered in a lump sum. Meanwhile, at the local level, Wisconsin counties and municipalities are expected to receive around $2.3 billion, largely in line with original estimates. Evers, for his part, has said he will continue to prioritize using the funds for businesses hit hard by COVID relief. He originally said in his framework that he put out a couple months ago now that he would designate $2.5 billion for economic recovery, including $600 million for businesses and $50 million for the tourism industry. Jara, what is the impact of having less funds designated to the state through ARPA, especially on Evers' allocation plans and on the budget process as a whole?
Well, on the budget, it's another possible delay. So remember, Republicans have been pushing Evers for his full plan, not a press release, they say, but a plan for a few weeks now. The problem is now the governor can't give them a full plan until he knows how it's going to be delivered, right? Is it one shot or two? Then he's got to reallocate the money. So $700 million was going to go for the pandemic response in general, and we're about $700 million less than where we were before. So some of that money is now going to come out of the small business funds or whatnot. He said the priorities will remain the same. Then there's, with the budget process, Republicans want this budget, this money, so they can build the budget around it. Evers wants them to supplement his budget with the money. So he doesn't see it as a factor in this, which is not how they view things. So what I'm watching for are, one, when do we get word about what's going to be one payment or two? I don't know that three members of Congress, a U.S. Senator, and a governor are going to switch the Treasury Department's guidance that they've put out for all 50 states. So, one, when are we going to figure that out for sure? Two, what's he going to do now? Was he going to have like a two-pronged approach? When will he make that decision? What will it look like? So we are kind of the part in Joint Finance Committee where it's largely, we call them cats and dogs, like smaller agencies, not big ticket items yet. So they're worried about it just yet, but at some point they need to know, or they want to know, where that money's going to go so they can start to figure out, okay, how much do they want to put in broadband, for example, versus what the governor proposed.
Right. And the other thing that's sort of factoring into all of this is the governor has until the end of 2024 to designate these funds, right? which outlives, as we've talked about previously, the length of the next budget cycle. But if this is split into two payments a year apart, the first one comes in, what, May this month, 2021?
Possibly, yes.
Yeah. Second one, 12 months later, May 2022. Will, you know, he's facing a re-election bid. We're assuming that he's going to run again in 6 months' time. Can he get all of the money out the door to ensure that he is the one who is able to pull the strings and designate where it's spent, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's kind of like good news, bad news, right? I mean, look, our unemployment rate is improving, so that's why we're getting less. Also, by the way, we're not really hurting. Like, there's a $1.9 billion budget surplus for this. Well, it's down a little bit more from that because of some tax cuts that the governor signed, the Republicans pushed. But we're talking like revenue growth plus a surplus. We're not hurting necessarily as a state for revenue to spend on stuff. So it's kind of interesting how this layers into that debate about, is this really trying to help people get back to where they were before? How is he going to do that? Because there's money to play with in this budget.
Yep. Let's hear now from Governor Evers and JFC co-chair Mark Bourne on their reaction to the $700 million reduction.
Obviously, that $700 million makes a difference. That's $700 million that we can't help people, our small businesses and others, to recover as quickly as we wanted to. When we think about the areas of the state that have been struggling so mightily, it's small businesses, Main Street businesses, bars, restaurants, and so on. And we will continue to make sure that they are a priority, even with the $700 million less.
It's interesting you said he's waiting for something else from the feds now. It was for a long time, I'm waiting for guidance. Now I'm waiting for them to tell me if they'll give me more money. At this point, we basically have a press release. A press release is not a plan. We've been asking for a plan for weeks. We've been willing to meet. We're still willing to meet with the governor to work on this. It would certainly make our budget process easier to have some leadership from the governor, some willingness for him to work with us and develop a plan for how this federal money can work with our state budget and investments to, you know, improve things in the state of Wisconsin.
Lawmakers this week approved policing changes and election changes in Assembly and Senate floor sessions. Senators signed off on measures to prevent municipal clerks from filling in missing information on absentee ballot envelopes and regulate ballot return events, essentially banning events like Madison's Democracy in the Park, unless certain standards are met. Trump targeted these issues in his attempts to overturn the 2020 elections. Assembly lawmakers also advanced a bill to ban local governments from using private funds to cover election-related costs. Meanwhile, the Senate okayed bills to change policing practices, including requirements to require agencies to post use of force policies online and require the Department of Justice to collect more data on use of force incidents. Meanwhile, the Assembly passed a bill to expand the statewide voucher program's income limits from 220% of the federal poverty level to 300%, and Assembly GOP leaders postponed voting to override Evers' vetoes of two COVID-related bills. JR, lots of action this week. What stood out to you in the floor debates?
The veto bait that we're looking at coming out of the legislature right now. Governor Evers, at last checked, I think he was at 17 vetoes so far this session. Back the last 20 or 30 years, the most a governor's vetoed of bills is like 21. So I'm pretty confident that Governor Evers will pass that number before the session is over. Look, with the election bills that are going through, there's one small one that I think might actually get done. It's about requiring the election commission to post draft minutes within like 48 hours of a meeting. That passed without much controversy. The other bills, though, were the same place we talked before. There's a conversation we had in Wisconsin about should there be private money being spent on election costs. It's a legitimate question to ask. Should clerks be filling in missing information, absentee ballot envelopes? Legitimate discussion to have. The way it's being had, though, conducted, is not going to be conducive to getting something done, because you have Republicans who are trying to answer to their base, who is some of them who are convinced that the election was quote-unquote stolen from President Trump, right? You have Democrats who are super paranoid about anything Republicans want to do to try and change election laws, because they're looking at Georgia and Florida saying we're next, and if it's not for Governor Evers, that's what's going to happen here. There's just not a productive conversation happening right now about what we do in Wisconsin, how we run elections. Don't forget, by the way, we have the most decentralized system in the country. For an election, we have 1,835 local clerks.
1,850.
Oh, thank you. 850 local clerks who run elections. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a different system, and there are mistakes made every election. But look, it's just not going to go very far. With the police bills, what's interesting is a couple got some bipartisan support, but one that's really going to have an issue is this overhauling of the police and fire commissions for Milwaukee and Madison. It's not for everybody. It's just the two largest cities right now, the way the bill is geared. And what's interesting about the debate this week in the Senate was that there were some personal issues that kind of popped up. The backdrop is that Lena Taylor, a Democrat from Milwaukee, ran for mayor against Tom Barrett last spring. She lost by about 25 points or so. She's the only Democrat who voted for these bills. And in the discussion, it wasn't really a Republican versus Democrat type discussion. It was more of a Democrat versus Democrat discussion, with Tanya Johnson, another Milwaukee Democrat, hinting at this is being driven, in her mind, by Lena's loss to Tom Barrett. Lena says that was not the case, but she also went a long list of issues she has with Tom Barrett and how he's run the appointments of the Police and Fire Commission. So that tells you that bill's not going to get done, right? It's just not going to happen. So I don't know. I just looking at, we've got a lot of virtual signaling, right? A resolution to send troops to the border. That's not going to convince Governor Evers to do anything differently. The bill about raising the income limits for school of choice, priority for Republicans, not going to happen with Democratic governor. So again, we're setting up like the difference between the two parties ahead of next fall, but we're not really getting substantive things done out of the legislature and this governor right now.
Yeah, the one thing you didn't touch on is these veto override attempts that were postponed until we don't really know when. Was any rationale given for not taking those votes? And of course, the rules surrounding passing veto overrides, for a refresher for all you listening, is you need a two-thirds majority of those present to support it. So with 98 members, because of the one vacancy, that's 66,
so
right?
66, yes.
And four Democrats then would need to go along with Republicans in supporting those, I believe.
No, yeah, they need six. They need six. It's 60-38 right
now
with
the
vacancy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just, it's this, they're not going to override a veto. I am kind of watching, though, when they bring it back, what's the message? I mean, they've already got them on record about the bill. A couple Democrats voted for both of those bills, too. They need four more for a veto override. It's not going to happen. But what's the point? Are they trying to drive the message home again about COVID stuff or what?
Well, last session we saw, I think by my count, it was five unsuccessful veto override attempts by the Assembly, right? I mean, they could continue that going into the remainder of this session, I suppose, but they mostly targeted, I believe, budget vetoes, I think, in the last session. So we'll see what happens after that's passed.
Yeah, was it the four abortion bills last time,
too?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes.
I think you're right. All right. Anyway, let's move on to a video then. We will hear from Representative Adam Nealon, a Republican, and Representative Lisa Subek on the elections bill on the Assembly floor.
What happened in Green Bay? It should scare you. They were able to push out the city clerk, not allow her to do her job to administer our elections, and allow outside paid political staff to administer the elections in Green Bay is a scary proposition. We need to do more to look at what happened this past election and say, that did not go well. Please acknowledge it. Please acknowledge that at least the appearance of impropriety is there. It is more than a cloud of impropriety. It's a smoky room.
Again and again, legislators on the Republican side of the aisle contributing to the big lie, saying that something untoward happened, when in reality we had transparent, safe, secure, and fair elections. And our poll workers, our clerks, our folks on the ground made sure of that. Money wasn't going in the counting rooms to change the results or bribe anybody or pay anybody off. The money went to ensuring that people could access the ability to vote, and the money went to ensure that our elections were free, safe, fair, and had the resources they needed to be administered well. That is something we should be proud of.
The Joint Finance Committee moved to create a new emergency fund for veterans' homes this week. Committee members unanimously voted to approve a $10 million fund for the state's veterans' homes to cover costs tied to future natural disasters or public emergencies. Lawmakers also signed off on motions surrounding the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, Educational Communications Board, Department of Financial Institutions, and more. Members rejected providing the Black Historical Society an extra $169,000 over the biennium on a 12-4 party line vote. In approving the Veterans Home Fund, Republicans knocked Evers and said he should have done more for the homes during the pandemic. Evers didn't request this funding. This is a new item from the Joint Finance Committee. Is this just a way to knock Evers on his COVID response, do you think?
A little bit. Remember that one of the complaints about past federal COVID money that Evers has spent is that put more toward nursing homes. Obviously, with the pandemic, they bore the brunt of the deaths, or a lot of them. There was the most concern about people in assisted care facilities because they were a captive audience, if you will, right? In one spot, my great uncle in an assisted care facility, he was not allowed to leave, basically, for a year. And so the complaint was that Evers wasn't doing more. So this is kind of like a little bit of a nudge at that, knocking him. So at the same time, you know, they approve this money. They hope they're not going to use it. I don't know how you're going to tap into it going forward, what the pandemic or natural disaster would be for that. But it's there. It's symbolic and kind of sends a message to Evers of, you didn't do enough. Oh, by the way, the partial veto authority can move that money around. But do you want to veto $10 million for a veteran's home? I don't know. We'll see when it comes. The budget goes back to him.
That's right. And on the Black Historical Society vote, there was a bit of a back and forth there between co-chair Mark Boren and Senator LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee. Boren said the reason it was rejected was because no one had expressly come to him and advocated for it. He then said individuals could look at Black history by going to the Capitol's third floor east wing, where there's about a 12-foot-long display case there containing about a dozen items. Johnson then responded, and I should note that she's the only Black member of the Joint Finance Committee, and she called that racist. JR, do you want to add anything about that?
So you have the backstory of the Joint Finance and how it works. One, when you're the minority on that committee, the four members who are not able to stop anything, your job is to message and to needle the majority and to kind of hold their feet to the fire about various things. And as you've watched that committee operate over years and years and years like I have, you've seen various tactics used to kind of really dig in on the majority party. In recent years, Republicans have placed new restraints on the minority to try and rein in these speeches. We've gone to 10 minutes per topic, per member, things like that, to try and stop the endless bars being thrown their way. Democrats have bristled at these efforts, so there's that backstory. Then you add in the extra layer of race and what's been going on in the Capitol, talking about everything of the past year, from since George Floyd, police conduct. I mean, add all the topics together. Oh, by the way, I think it's been 2 years now since the Assembly passed a Black History Month resolution, because there's tension there about who Black lawmakers want to honor and who white leadership says, no, we want these people included as well. So there's all this powder keg going on, and it kind of came to bear during the hearing on Thursday. Now, the questions I have are, okay, going forward, is there going to be effort to smooth things over? Are they going to have a conversation about being a little more civil toward each other in future hearings? Or is this going to be just a preview of a long, painful summer in the Joint Finance Room and what's going to happen with that budget?
Right, exactly. And we'll see how Co-Chair Boren and Co-Chair Markland handle that going forward. Moving on to our last topic of the day, we have a lot of congressional news. So I'm going to do my best to summarize it right now. We'll start off with Wisconsin's five House Republicans who joined the push to remove Liz Cheney from her role as chair of the chamber's Republican conference. That vote happened on Wednesday. It was a voice vote. Meanwhile, four House members have requested earmarks totaling nearly $150 million since the process was brought back earlier this year, as reported by WisPolitics.com. U.S. Representative Mark Pocan requested $76 million. Ron Kind, $47.5 million. Gwen Moore, $24.1 million. And Scott Fitzgerald, $930,000. Meanwhile, former Wisconsin Department of Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm was officially confirmed as Deputy Health and Human Services Secretary on a 61-37 vote in the U.S. Senate. And U.S. Senators Baldwin and Johnson have sent on the names of five candidates to become the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. So much news to sift through here, JR. We'll talk a little bit more about the Liz Cheney stuff and stock reports. So I think I want to focus here on earmarks. They've obviously been sort of brought back, right? Yep. After a decade of not being used. And I should note that these are used to target spending projects in members' districts. So it can be a way to get members on board, and especially useful, right, when Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate are so small. But anyway, I've previously talked to Pocan about how he wants to use these earmarks, and he said that it would let him advocate more strongly for projects tied to UW-Madison and the University of Wisconsin system. What have you seen from these requests so far?
Well, remember, they're just requests. There's not a guarantee. The House Appropriations Committee will kind of sift through them all and decide where things are going to go, at least in their version, right? Because you have the Senate to think about as well. What really caught my attention was that Scott Fitzgerald asked for an earmark. So remember, a decade ago, we had this Tea Party movement, rebellion against Obamacare that really brought in, or rebellion against Obamacare and federal spending that would brought in the Tea Party movement, right? And Republicans went to ban earmarks at the time because they were the bridge to nowhere in Alaska, all these examples of wasteful spending. You know, it was bringing home the pork had gone awry. A decade later, you have a freshman member of the House delegation asking for $1 million basically in earmarks. Now, they're not big money. They're not the bridge to nowhere type things. half of it, a little more than half, would go toward this water system in Waukesha. Remember, Waukesha's got all kinds of water issues because of contamination in their wells. There's been this whole issue because they straddled the divide of the two watersheds, right? So can they draw water from Lake Michigan or not? There's been that debate. Other half goes to a lab at Children's Hospital. These are not like controversial things, right? But still, he asked for it. Other three Republicans did not. Ron Johnson does not like earmarks, four Republicans did not. Ron Johnson is not a fan of earmarks. So I guess my question kind of is, what's this mean for Fitzgerald? Does it mean that, one, the Trump base that now is kind of the Republican base is moved past that concern about deficit spending or deficits or in general? Because, they really haven't heard talk about that from those Republican base in the last couple, 4 years. Is there any danger for him in doing this? And oh, by the way, there's a redistricting backdrop, right? So in years past, the senior members of the delegation kind of got together and drew the map and gave it to Lawmakers and said, okay, here's the map. You guys go past this now. Jim Sensenbrenner, who preceded Fitzgerald in that seat, was in that seat for 40 years plus. He made sure that was a deep red district. It was always 60% plus as long as he was there. Well, now that Fitzgerald's a freshman, he doesn't have that kind of pull. Well, by the way, the suburbs in Milwaukee are kind of changing a little bit, right? So as districts get redrawn, whether by a map the legislature signs off on and governors approves or by the courts, maybe Fitz has got to worry a little bit what that is going to look like going forward. And showing that you're somebody who's going to try and help projects back home might be a little nod to like, hey, I'm paying attention to what's important. So there's all kinds of layers to the earmark discussion that I'm kind of watching and fascinated by. And it's not a surprise that Democrats asked for it. They're in power. You know, they've had pent-up demand for 10 years. But that Fitzgerald kind of caught people's attention that he asked for it and kind of like what got to watch that going forward.
That redistricting component is really interesting, too, because there was, prior to the last decade, there was sort of this gentleman's agreement, right, that would go on between Feingold and Sensenbrenner, and that would be sort of how the congressional maps were redrawn year to year. Obviously, that changed in the last decade. I believe it was Paul Ryan that took the lead on it that time. Do you have any sense of who's taking the lead on it this time? Usually the most senior member, isn't it?
Yes. Well, what's interesting is you have a different dynamic because Governor Evers is so invested in his people's maps. So I've asked members of the delegation and their staffs, like, okay, is there any real talks going on about a new map? And they've not really given me a good answer so far. And one of the questions has been, even if you had, for example, the senior members are Ron Kind, and actually Glenn Grothman, who's been there for less than a decade. So it's a much different dynamic. But if they drew a map, and let's say it locked in a 5-3 conservative Republican majority, but it shored up Ron Kind and kind of gave him a more Democratic district, would Governor Evers sign a map like that because he is personally invested in the people's maps, right, which aren't going to become law, but will be a filing in a lawsuit we're going to see at some point, state or federal court, about these maps? I don't know the answer to that question right now. So, and if you're a Republican, you could get a court-drawn map that would be 6-2 in your favor because it's not hard to see Ron Kind's district getting worse, right? But you could also see a map that goes back to 4-4. So, I mean, there's all kinds of layers about, like, what your incentive is. And often for incumbents, it's to protect their own turf. So if they all come out safe, maybe they'd be happy with it. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see going forward. Let's move on to stocks now, JR. What's rising?
So Leslie, legal bills, couple developments. Now, we've been tracking legal bills at WisPolitics.com for the last 2+ years with legislature. They're up to more than $7 million in legal fees since January 1st of 2019 through the end of March, basically this year. Well, now we've got two things going on. One, Dane County judge had basically overturned two contracts lawmakers had signed to basically retain counsel for in anticipation of a lawsuit over redistricting. Judge said, can't do that. Then this week, refused to put his ruling on hold to restore those contracts while it's being appealed. We now have an appeal filed with the Third District Court of Appeals by Republican lawmakers who also now asked an emergency motion, expedited motion with the appeals court to have a decision they hope by next Friday to restore those contracts while it's all being, that's going to be more legal fees for taxpayers to pick up. And now we have Republican lawmakers looking to intervene in a lawsuit West Virginia filed with 12 other states, I believe at this point, challenging a provision in the federal COVID bill that says if you accept the federal money, you cannot directly or indirectly lower taxes. Now, I'm going to bet you that most of those other states, because they're representative Republican attorneys general are going to argue pretty much what the Wisconsin Republicans are going to argue, right? That they shouldn't be bound by this. This is somehow unconstitutional, but they want to have their say. And it's going to cost taxpayers money to let them have their say.
Yeah, exactly. Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat, sort of declined to get involved in the lawsuit after Republicans passed a resolution urging him to do so. So that there's all that interesting backstory there, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, what's mixed this week?
Mike Gallagher. So you mentioned the Cheney thing. So rewind 3 weeks, 3 months, I'm sorry. Mike Gallagher was defending Liz Cheney, saying, you know, no, she should not be pushed out of leadership. He's also standing up and demanding President Trump at the time to call off his supporters and try and do something to stop what was going on in the Capitol on January 6th. Now you fast forward, and Gallagher has joined the effort to get rid of Cheney. Now, there'll be a couple things there. One, Liz Cheney not only broke with President Trump, but didn't stop speaking about breaking with President Trump. When you're a conference chair, you're supposed to kind of be part of the team and be focused on message. That's not helping the message for some Republicans. So that may be part of it. But also, Gallagher's had a little bit of a problem with the Republican base. And why I say that is the base Republican Party has really become really pro-Trump. And Gallagher's broken with Trump on things like funding the border wall in the last session, things like that. So some people see this as maybe a little bit of him trying to like shore things up or kind of like showing that he is on the same page as the president on some things. Also, Gallagher's been on a little bit of a tear about Dr. Fauci and the origin of the COVID-19 virus, if it came out of that lab in China, getting the bottom of that. That's kind of a big issue with some of the Trump base as well. So he seems to be trying to like play that base a little bit. Now, what happens when you do that is the Democrats who gave you some kind of credit for like standing up to Trump back in January and standing behind Cheney are going, well, what's this now? You know, you flip-flopped on this whole thing. And the Republicans who maybe had some concerns about you were kind of going, well, do I trust this? Gallagher is a candidate for statewide office if Ron Johnson doesn't run, maybe even for governor. And the question is, does he have a base problem in a statewide race? I get the impression that if, like, for his own congressional district, there's not really a problem necessarily for him. But in a statewide primary, would this be an issue for him? Gallagher fans tell me, look how much he raised, $830,000 the first quarter of this year. Look at how he outperformed Trump in that district last fall. He doesn't have a base problem. They say he'd be a great candidate statewide. He's right on the issues, but just something to watch with him.
Definitely. And what's falling this week, Jerry?
So Deb Kerr, look, lots of campaigns that lose finish in the red when it's all said and done. But the way she ran her campaign maybe makes it harder for her to get donations to cover that shortfall. So remember, Kerr tried to strike this position where she was a little bit of everything for everybody, right? She was a self-proclaimed Joe Biden supporter and a Democrat who advocated for school choice, also called for schools to reopen. And in the last weeks of the campaign, leaned into the transgender athlete issue, right? So now if you are a Republican donor, are you encouraged to like give money to Deb Kerr to settle her debts because she's a Joe Biden Democrat? Maybe a little bit harder to write that check than if it was somebody who was, you know, more part of the like-minded cause, right? If you're a Democrat, are you going to write a check for Deb Kerr when she leaned into the transgender issue the last couple weeks of the campaign? I don't know. I mean, there are probably people who are going to step up and help her retire that debt. It's going to be a little bit harder for her to get those checks written than maybe somebody else would have because of the way she ran her campaign. And look, I get why she did it. It's an interesting approach to try and be an appealing candidate outside of the normal labels in that race, but it just makes it more difficult in a situation like this.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Jer. So exciting to be back in studio with you in person. Very, very exciting. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for May 14th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.